Warmer weather is on its way, and that means it's time to start thinking about spring maintenance around your home. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, Chad Spate. Chad is the owner of Chad's Design Build, and we talk with him every other month about home improvement and repair. Today we're looking at a whole bunch of things, including water issues, roofing, siding repairs, and a whole lot more. You may have some questions for him. I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And Chad Spate, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you are in sunny and warm St. Petersburg, Florida as we speak.
I am looking at the Gulf of Mexico right now, and it's a beautiful sunny day. It's about 80 degrees, and I hope I bring back all of this lovely weather to Wisconsin with me next
week. Yeah, it's not quite that way here right now.
And I know.
It's been a kind of an unusual winter. And I know I was maybe a week ago in southern Wisconsin. There was a lot of rain. There's, of course, a lot of snow, and I'm wondering if you've seen water management issues with your clients?
We have, Larry. I mean, this time of year is always the most challenging. Of course, in winters when we have a lot of snow that melts rapidly, that's the most challenging. So this year we really didn't have that problem. But nonetheless, when the ground is frozen and rain falls, that means that the water is going to go into every little crevice, every low spot, and if the water is soaking in along the edge of a foundation, then you can end up with a pretty damp basement pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So that can be an issue.
Yeah, it sure can. Somebody called not long ago and asked to talk about the importance of sump pumps, something of which I am intimately familiar given my home next to Lake Monona. But maybe you could talk a little bit, review a bit about sump pumps and what they, who should have one.
Sure. Well, whenever you have a basement that gets seasonal or intermittent bulk water in the basement, water actually flowing on the floor, then you're probably a good candidate for a sump system. And typically what is done, if you do not have a drain tile going around the perimeter of your foundation underneath the cement floor, we can retrofit that drain tile. And that involves trenching the perimeter of your basement, literally breaking up the cement and digging down next to the footing and putting in a perforated drain tile. And that will collect the water on the perimeter of the basement, and all of that drain tile leads to a single sump pit where the pump will then pump out the water as it collects in what is basically about a 5 to 8 gallon container that is set down into the floor of your basement. So it's a great system to have. Many newer homes are built with this system. It's just part of the way we would thoughtfully build a home so that you can deal with the problem if you have it. But many older homes that have been built, say 30 years ago or later, they often do not have this system, so we have to retrofit it. But it's typically done entirely from the inside.
Yeah, very interesting. What about other maintenance issues that we should be looking for this spring before we go to our phones?
Sure. Well, making sure that your downspouts are operating properly is often the culprit for water in a basement. So typically we find that a downspout is overflowing or the gutters are overflowing because they're clogged, or a downspout has gotten disconnected up against the house, and so the water is not being diverted away from the foundation, but it's literally getting collected and then dumped right at the corner of the foundation. Issues like that can be very problematic, and because the system may have been functioning fine last year, people don't realize, you know, why all of a sudden they've got water coming into a part of their basement. And it, often it's those exterior water management systems that are the culprit. It's also possible that with the winter, with various freeze-thaw cycles, that patios or walkways have gotten heaved or they have sunken in, and now the water is moving in a slightly different direction. And that, too, can cause problems that didn't exist last year. So generally, that's where what we do. We walk around the home, and we make sure that things are functioning as they should, that the gutters are clean, that everything is connected, and getting water away from the home.
You know, see, I was thinking as you were talking about my current home, where I had some water issues when I first moved back in, and I added about 4 feet to the extender of the downspout, and it was only 4 feet, and that took the problem away entirely. Sometimes it doesn't take much.
That's correct. That's correct. And often, you know, and sometimes people will have those, you know, that sort of a diverter, and it still doesn't solve the problem. And then when we look, what we find is that due to the grade of their yard, the water is coming right back to the foundation, maybe not where the downspout is, but 10 or 20 feet away. So, you know, connecting those dots and making sure that the water stays out a good 4 feet from the foundation so that it can percolate into the soil, that's really what it's all about.
Well, we have some callers online. By the way, you can get on pretty quickly with your question at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call, and we'll turn to Patricia in Madison first. Patricia, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call, Larry and Chad. I'm considering painting my kitchen cupboards white, and they are wooden cupboards and have kind of a pecan colored stain on them and varnish. And I'm wondering, how can I get by without having to strip all that's on there right now?
What do you think, Chad?
That's a great question. So sometimes, depending on the residue and different things that may have collected on that wood surface, the cleaning and proper preparation of those wood cupboards is not too difficult. And that's what's going to have to happen to make sure that any painting that is done lasts for a long time. You know, it's all in the preparation. So typically what we're going to do is clean those cabinets well, do a light sanding. And then often we're going to use an oil-based primer to make sure that we get really good adhesion to the wood prior to putting the top coat finish on it.
So you're saying I wouldn't have to varnish remove then?
So often an older cabinet with a good cleaning and then, like I say, a light sanding that just dulls the finish, so that is sufficient if you're actually looking to paint the cabinets. If you were looking to refinish them, then you would have to make sure that all of the varnish is removed to get down to the raw wood. But that's not necessarily the case if you're painting them. You just have to have a surface that will accept the primer and get good adhesion. Does that make sense?
Well, it sounds better to me.
I think you made a happy customer here, Chad. thanks, Patricia. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh boy, Paul in Eau Claire. Let's go to you next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I have a sump pump, and it works fine. It really needs it to run once or twice a year, usually. Then it sits in water year round unless I manually get in there and pull out the water. Is it okay to leave that residue water in there with the pump sitting in that 3-5 inch depth water?
That's a great question, Paul. So those pumps are designed to be submerged in water, and it is true that a properly installed sump pump is going to be sealed. So the sump pit itself will be sealed. So you may have some standing water in that pit. And as long as the pump is continuing to operate as it should, I would not see that as a problem. I mean, of course, typically some evaporation will take place, and
there's a little evaporation, but and I usually pull all the water out manually, and even then it doesn't dry out totally, but essentially it's done. Right. But I've always wondered if it's better to do that or just leave the water in there.
I don't think there's a problem with leaving the water in there. Is the sump pit itself sealed on the top, or is it open?
It's mostly closed with a little lid that fits on there.
Okay. I asked the question because I don't know if you've ever had your basement tested for radon, but radon is a naturally occurring soil gas that is harmful to us in our homes, and it comes out of the soil, and a sump pit and the drain tile that connects to it are connected to the soil very well by design. And so if there is radon under your home, it's going to be coming into your basement from that sump pit. And so it's important to test for that to make sure you don't have that problem. And then if you do have that problem, or if you would just like to dry out that sump pit on a regular basis, putting in a radon remediation fan connected to the sump pit will do two things. It will remove radon if you have it, and it will also dry out that pit and the entire drainage system by ventilating it. Huh. So then you get that added benefit of keeping things drier, which then makes the soil under your home more receptive to soaking up moisture when you do get a heavy rainfall, allowing the entire system to work better. So that might be worth looking into to deal both with your moisture problem and then any potential radon problem.
Yeah, I understand your point, although that's an additional cost and maintenance thing too. So there's a trade-off, but I appreciate your comments.
Yeah, thanks so much for calling. Tom and Wanakee may have some follow-ups relating to radon. Tom, hi.
I have questions about radon.
Yeah.
Yeah, how timely. So you've answered some of it. So I saw an item at one of the retail stores about covering a sump pit, and it had a couple of the PVC pipes going out of it, and I suppose that's part of that remediation process or kit. My question originally was going to be about testing. I've been doing some research on it, and some is short term, and some is up to 90 or 91 days. And number one, how long should you test, and what's effective, the 72 hour or multiple days or whatever, and how often should it be tested, or should you test for it?
Yeah, so that, well, those are great questions, Tom. So, you know, the problem with radon levels in a home is that they can fluctuate throughout the year. So you might test for radon using a short-term test and find that you really don't have a radon problem, or you might have radon at a level that's considered to be safe. The standard is that when we have more than four picoliters of radon detected, that is the action level according to the EPA. The European standard is 2.6 picoliters, which is a little more conservative. Anything from 2.6 to 4, you're on that, you know, what's considered to be too high of a radon level to ignore. But you might test at a time of year when the radon level is below that. It's impossible to say for sure at any given home what's going to lead to higher levels. But generally, the winter time is when radon levels tend to spike because the ground is frozen. all around our homes. And so the radon cannot get out there, and the ground under our house is not frozen. And so the radon is able to escape into our homes. And it's also a time when our homes are closed up. And whenever we turn on an exhaust fan, we are sucking air out of the house. And any air that might be under our foundation is getting brought in to help make up that pressure differential. And if there's radon in the soil, it's going to come right in with that air. So the best time to test is in the winter, generally. And then we always recommend a plug-in radon detector that's going to give you continuous digital readings of your radon level. And it'll have a beeper that will go off if that level hits the action point. And it, you know, similar to a carbon monoxide detector, it tracks the highest reading that you may have had, and that way you don't have to worry about whether or not your radon levels, you know, were peaking at the time that you tested for them. That way you can look at that detector and know what your recent radon readings were, and then know whether or not it makes sense to take action. To answer your question about the sump pit, you know, what's important is that the pipes coming out of that lid are sealed.
Uh-huh.
And a properly installed sump pit is going to have sealed bushings around those pipes. One of the pipes is going to be the drainage pipe for the sump pump to pump water out of that pit. And then typically there's a larger 4-inch pipe that is coming out to pull air out of the pit for the radon fan.
There we go. Tom, good luck, and thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build, today about home improvement, spring maintenance issues. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're taking a look at home improvement and spring maintenance with Chad Spade of Chad's Design Build. The lines are all filled. Here's the number, though. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And we're going to turn next to Jeff in Sparta. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind today?
A question. I had a new steel roof put on last summer, and I was real pleased with it, the installation and the roof that I have. However, this winter, I realized that the snow creeps off that thing pretty bad. And I've heard that there's some kind of snow rails or something like that that you can install, and I was wondering what you would recommend. It's starting to move some of the gutter supports that I have onto my eave. The screws are coming out of that because of it's so heavy. So I was just wondering
Yeah.
Sure. Well, those are good questions, Jeff. And so typically what we see with a metal roof is we are going to have these little spurs that are attached near the bottom of the roof, and they are there precisely to prevent sheets of ice and snow from rapidly sliding off the roof. And typically, a roofing contractor is going to install those for you, and I would recommend that you call the contractor whom you hired to do the original work, because that way you don't have to worry about voiding the warranty or anything like that. It is a feature that can be installed in locations that are problematic. They don't have to be all the way around the house. It depends on the pitch of the roof and the orientation to the sun, and whether or not it's a pathway that leads up to the home where you would not want to be suddenly covered in ice or snow. So
it's particularly bad right at my garage door where the vehicles are parked out front.
Yeah, well, that would be an area where they'd put those spurs in, wouldn't it?
Okay. Definitely. Yeah. So So I would recommend that you call the contractor and let them know your concerns, and they should be able to help you. There probably will be some costs involved, but I don't expect it to be much. And then they should help you with with the gutter issue as well, and properly reinstalling them. So
there we go.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Thank you for calling. Johnny in Madison, you are next. Hi, Johnny.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a problem with my sump pump. It's a high-end system. I've never seen one like it. I just bought this house a few months ago. The water goes out over an underground drain field made up of rocks. Anyway, my problem is the grass around the house is always spongy and wet, and I'm wondering, is this drain field not working? Is the water not going where it's supposed to go?
Yeah,
that sounds like an interesting and somewhat unusual situation. I'm not sure what exactly the answer to that might be without looking at it. I would ask you, is your home in a low-lying area that, is there a water table? Are you close to a lake, close to a stream, anything like that?
I'll put it this way. My neighbors across the street are up on a hill, and my neighbors behind me are down a hill. It's kind of like I'm on a plateau in between a higher and a lower level.
I got you.
Okay, but that's good. So you're not at the low point, at least.
Right.
So, okay. Yeah, well, so the critical thing is to make sure that the water coming from the higher elevation is able to be shunted away from your foundation and, to keep your house dry, and then, of course, to allow it to continue to go downhill without being a problem for the neighbor below you. So I might recommend, talking to a landscaper. We work with a couple of landscapers in the Madison area that are really good at solving water problems. And that sounds like, perhaps the soil preparation is an issue in these rock beds. But I would think, given that you're not at the bottom of, in a valley up along a body of water, that, you should not have that soggy ground as a constant nuisance.
Yeah. So, and a landscaper, how would you look for a landscaper, Chad?
I would recommend the NARI website, the NARI of Madison website in the Madison area. I think Johnny would say he's from Madison.
Yeah.
So that's what I would recommend for a professional landscaper. Someone that deals with the sorts of issues that you have. I would interview a few people and find out, if these individuals have dealt with similar problems, and then you should be able to get some advice and some cost estimates on what might be done to deal with it.
And what's the NARI website?
I believe that it is nariofmadison.org.
So N-A-R-A?
N-A-R-I.
N-A-R-I, excuse me. NARI, N-A-R-I of Madison.org. And no matter where you were in the state, you could, put your location in with NARI and probably find what you need.
That's correct. And NARI is a national organization, so if you go on to the national website, or if you just Google NARI, you'll likely find associations in your area, or the national site will help take you where you'd be able to get some assistance.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Johnny, for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Reg in Madison next. Hi, Reg. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call today. My question is about having drywall installed in my garage. It is already finished. I'm sorry, it's already insulated, and it has drywall over top of that. Is that a good idea? Do I need to add a vapor barrier? What's the right answer?
Great question. So, well, let's talk about your garage a little bit. Is your garage attached to your home, or is
yes, it
a detached?
It
okay, it's attached. So the wall between the house and the garage, that needs to have insulation, and if it has a vapor barrier, it needs to be on the heated side of the wall. So you
okay,
would not,
it does.
Okay, okay. And then that drywall, of course, would need to be at least what we call fire taped, which is one coat of drywall compound installed to prevent air from moving into that wall in the event of a fire. So the other walls, it is perfectly fine to put up insulation. And if you put up a vapor barrier there, you would apply it on the interior side of those walls. And then the drywall would go over it. The vapor barrier is really only going to be of value if you are actively heating that space with a supplemental heater of some sort.
Sure. And where I'm at now is that the garage is insulated, and it has plywood over all of the walls, with the exception of the one that adjoins the house, which does have the 5/8 sheetrock over it. So do I need, I guess my question is, do I need to put a vapor barrier over the plywood before putting the sheetrock up, or just put up the sheetrock over the existing plywood?
Well, I would say that the vapor barrier, if you do put up a vapor barrier, I would recommend that you use what we call a smart vapor barrier, which would be a product that is not just Visqueen plastic. Because if you put up Visqueen, then you are going to have an impenetrable vapor barrier in that wall. And so in the event you have a minor water leak, let's say, from the exterior side that gets into that wall, the wall will never be able to dry out. And we do want the wall, if it does get wet in a rare circumstance, to be able to dry out. So there are some products that are available that can be applied that are smart vapor barriers that will allow, if the humidity rises, they will allow vapor to pass out of that wall. One product that we use is called Membrane.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that it's manufactured by Owens Corning, but it's called Membrane, and there's an interior side and an exterior side, you know, so you just have to make sure you put it up the right way. But you could put that up over the plywood. But generally, if you're not going to be actively heating the space, or if you do it only on rare occasions, it probably is not a major concern, you know, to have that vapor barrier.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much for calling, Reg. Appreciate your call. As long as we're talking about garages, let's go to a question from Dave in Madison, who wonders if there are, he's in Madison, wondering if there are restrictions for putting running water in his garage in Madison.
Wow, that's a great question. I don't believe so. I mean, certainly, we have spigots on the exterior of our homes, which we simply have to manage from a freezing perspective, making sure that the water lines don't freeze in the wintertime. I've occasionally had some clients that have wanted work sinks out in their garage, and so similar precautions have to be taken to make sure those water lines do not freeze in the wintertime. But I don't know of any code that would prohibit having something like a sink out in the garage. It's just simply a matter of taking the precautions that it's not a maintenance problem.
Yep. I would agree with that. Sue in Sparta has something for us. Hi, Sue. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about a composite decking that we have. We purchased the house with it, and the problem is in the summer, it's way too hot. In the winter, it's slippery, and even in the rain, it becomes such a, you know, safety hazard. And is there anything that they make that maybe could, I was thinking, you know, could coat the deck or something to make it a rough and less.
Sure. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear about those issues. Those are not uncommon problems. And a few things that I would say is that there was a time, and there's still some products out there now, which are quite slippery. And I would say earlier on in the composite decking, when it was first being manufactured and utilized, more of those products were slippery than they are now. What we increasingly see is a pretty pronounced texture embossed into that product that will make it safer to walk on no matter what time of year. And then that issue of the dark decking being too hot, that is a very difficult issue to resolve, because even if you were to try to apply some sort of a paint or something onto that product, because it is a dark product, it is going to absorb the heat. I think you would have failure if you tried to apply something to it to make it lighter. Now, having said that, there are some products out there which are synthetic products that are designed to be a thin layer installed over top of an existing deck. It might be possible to consider installing one of those thinner layers that would give you a lighter product and give you a better, better traction. But unfortunately, once you have a dark synthetic deck that gets a lot of sun exposure, generally my recommendation is that those decks are appropriate for the north or the east side of a home. But if they're on the south or the west, they are going to get too hot to ever sit on, unless you only use them in the early morning hours. So I don't think there's a simple answer to that. Of course, if there's a way to shade it, that would be another potential solution. There are some sunshade products that you might be able to consider. But I don't think there's a particularly low-cost way to make those problems go away, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, thank you much. It still gives me some, better idea.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call, and we'll get you on pretty quickly, actually. Bob in Eau Claire up next. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call, Larry. I appreciate it. I've always wanted to say this. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Right, Bob.
And I do have a question. I have been listening. I do have a question. But before I do that, and I'm sure I'm late to the party, at least I hope I'm late to the party, that it's been well known on your program and the rest of the Ideas Network that Larry Mueller is getting a much-deserved recognition this summer, being inducted into the Wisconsin Broadcasters Hall of Fame. All his colleagues and the people that have gone through his classes over the years at the university and taught with him in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences are thrilled to death. Believe me that Larry will finally be in that Hall of Fame and accepted and recognized for the tremendous effort he's done, not just on the radio, but in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. So congratulations, Larry. There are a lot of folks that are thrilled to death for you.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
And I do have a question, though.
Okay.
I have a question as far as construction. And in my house, I've got in my garage a floor drain. But looking at some new construction, I was told that these garage floor drains are no longer legal in Wisconsin. Is that true? If you're going to build a new house with a garage, you can no longer put one of those floor drains in there?
Well, yeah, I mean, the simple answer is yes, that is true. And the reason for that has to do with the fact that oil and other contaminants can leak out of the bottom of a vehicle and then end up in the sewage system, and that's not what we would want. So you've got to put in a higher-end drainage system that is going to capture any contaminants if you do have such a system out in a garage. So that's just, I mean, without going into greater detail, that's essentially the answer to your question. Does that make sense?
Very good. Thank you very much.
All right.
Congratulations.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, boy. Bob Bozold, one of my former students, as a matter of fact, and now a broadcaster in Wax Radio in Eau Claire, among other places. Mary in Green Bay, we are going to turn to you. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I have a garage that was built when the house was built in 1928, and it has a floor that's badly cracked, and as a consequence, the building is in springtime sinking and getting exposed to a lot of water. There's been some wood rot coming in because of that. So I'm wondering if it's too late to have the building raised and a new floor put under, or raised up and then the new floor put down, or should I just have the whole thing demolished and replaced with a new garage? So I'm wondering what would be more cost-effective. Yeah. It's a detached garage.
Detached, okay.
Okay. Yeah, so, well, those are great questions, and, of course, without being able to assess it in person, it's hard to know what is the appropriate answer to your question. But I will say that often with a structure like that that's 90 years old, the deterioration of the slab, and we see this all the time, I mean, that's, you know, a 90-year-old cement slab under that structure, there is no cost-effective way to replace that slab without removing and rebuilding the structure. And so it's probably going to make sense at some point here in the next 10 years to just rebuild the entire thing. But there are a couple of things that you might want to think about. If your garage is within typically 3 feet of your property line, the municipality, Green Bay, may not allow you to rebuild the new structure as close to the lot line as your current garage is. If it is within the limited setbacks, then you'll have to apply for a variance. And so that's going to add some expense if it's important to rebuild it in the same place. Typically, they will allow you to repair the structure in that location, but once you rebuild it, you generally have to apply to comply with the setback codes. That's not necessarily a very expensive process, and you may be granted the variance. I know that in the city of Madison and some of the surrounding communities, we've often granted a variance to rebuild a detached garage in a similar to where it used to be, but there's no guarantee that's going to happen. But I would say generally, because that foundation slab is so important for maintaining the stability of the structure, the time is going to come that you're just going to have it all torn out, and then the good news is you probably won't have to worry much about maintenance for a number of decades once that garage is properly rebuilt.
Oh, There we go. I did some work. I had a somewhat similar problem, Mary, in my own garage, and I there weren't eaves and downspouts, and I installed some proper ones and took away some of the water issues that were affecting my garage, which is a detached garage as well.
Okay. Yes, this doesn't have downspouts or eaves at all.
Yeah, and that can definitely help get the water away from the garage. I can assure you of that.
Okay. So if it's 3 foot from the property line, then it would be possibly granted a variance, or I could have a new garage put in.
Yes.
Is that what I gather?
Yes.
Yes. If it's right, many times older garages are right on the, almost directly on the property line with your neighbor.
Yes.
And so in that case, you know, you might not be able to rebuild it right that close to the property line. So that's just something you'd want to talk to, you know, go down to the municipal offices and talk to the zoning officials and find out if your garage could be rebuilt in the same location.
Okay.
Got it. All right. Okay. Thank you so much for your help today.
Yep. Thanks a
You're
lot
welcome.
For calling. Appreciate it. And let's just move on to Beaver Dam, Wisconsin, and talk to Dave. Dave, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling today, taking us back up onto the roof of a house. Oftentimes in wintertime, my plumbing vent pipe freezes over with the shape of a snow cone on the top. And consequently, as a result, you get a smell of the septic gases in the basement of the home.
Yeah.
I'm a former firefighter, and I've gone up on the roof, which is, this season it was a safe climb. It was a dry roof, but I've had to go up there and alleviate and break up that snow cone in order to vent the gases back out to the exterior. I'm wondering, is there a way I can prevent this from happening in the future, possibly painting that vent PVC pipe black, or is there an attachment that you could add to that pipe that might be a solar reflector
to fix it that way? What do you think, Chad?
Yeah, well, there's some great questions. So my concern would be that perhaps the pipe itself has some sort of obstruction in it that is allowing this to happen. And so the first thing that I might consider doing is trying to scope into that vent pipe and see if there is something that the snow is, you know, basically piling up on top of to allow that frozen cap to form. Because oftentimes, because if you have an unobstructed vent pipe, the water is, if any snow or ice or rain is going to fall into that pipe, and the heat that is coming out of the plumbing system will, you know, getting, you know, 2 or 3 foot blizzard, you know, the heat is going to more than adequately melt any snow or ice and prevent this from happening. So that would be my first concern, is that is there something in that pipe that allowing the snow to build up in a way that it would not typically be able to do. The other thing that you could consider doing is installing some sort of a diverter on top of that that would prevent the snow and ice from falling directly into that pipe. Generally, we want a plumbing pipe to be exposed and allow the rain and things to fall into it, because it just, you know, it cleans out that pipe, basically. But given the problem you're having, if there isn't an obstruction, there are some caps that can be installed that will essentially allow the air to move horizontally once it reaches the top, and then it will prevent, you know, the snow and ice from capping it, I would hope, in the wintertime. So those would be my two suggestions.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Chad Spate, our guest today of Chad's Design Build. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at home improvement and spring maintenance today with Chad Spate of Chad's Design Build. We'll go right back to the phones, and Renee and Madison up next. Hi, Renee. What's on
Good
your
morning.
Mind? Hi.
Hi there. I have a home on the east side of Madison, and about in, I think around the 1940s, somebody came through and put slate siding that has an asbestos in it on the home. I now have a number of maintenance, exterior maintenance issues that are going to require disturbing the siding And I'm wondering how to go about doing that. Is it just to the best idea just to throw up my hands and re-side the house?
Well, that is a common conundrum when you have that contaminated material on the outside of your home, and you are not alone in facing that. You basically got two options. One option mm-hmm. would be to have a professional abatement company come in and remove the siding in conjunction with the other projects that you're looking to do. In other words, to properly alter the siding, but to then allow those alterations or maintenance projects to move forward. The other more broad solution to the problem that will allow you and future owners of the home to kind of do what you wish to the exterior is to have that siding professionally removed by an asbestos abatement contractor and then re-sided so that this is no longer an issue for you or a future owner. And that's, of course, an expensive proposition, but at some point, it's something we all face when we own a home that has that asbestos siding on it.
Sure. How do I go about finding a contractor to do work like that?
It's a great question. Again, I recommend the NARI of Madison, and you live in Madison, but for anyone in our listening audience, they can go to the NARI.org website. It's NARI.org or NARI of Madison.org. And the NARI, the National Association of the Remodeling Industry, is an excellent association that has a high standard of ethics that all of its members must adhere to. And it's a great resource for consumers to find competent professionals in pretty much every area of home renovation. And there are asbestos abatement contractors typically in each local association.
There we go.
Wonderful. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling. And Bob in Franklin, it's your turn. Hi, Bob.
Oh, hi. I've got a garage with a concrete floor. And I was thinking about putting a surface on it to make it easier to clean, but at the same time, I don't want it to get slippery when it's wet. Is there anything out there that would work for that?
Well, when you say a surface, I mean, are you talking about something that would be painted onto the cement, or...
I've seen advertisements where they put a finish... You know, it could be a smooth paint finish, or are there some other rough finishes they put on?
Right.
Yeah.
I'm not really familiar with them, but I've seen ads.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if the cement floor is in reasonably good shape, then you might be a candidate for one of these applied finishes. There are companies that specialize in applying, it's often a urethane epoxy finish to the cement floor. And that would, and some of those finishes are designed to have quite a lot of texture and friction to them to help prevent you from creating a slippery floor. But they do look nice, and they can certainly be easier to clean up. There are also some overlayment options, some heavy-duty products, and I confess that I don't really have any experience with these products, and I would not, I can't endorse anything, but there are products out there that can be rolled out onto the floor, and that might be an option as well, and often those have an embossed surface on them that, again, has some friction and is going to give you traction.
Interesting. Thanks.
Oh, Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Bob, for calling. Appreciate your call. Bill in Oregon, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Got a question about wood siding. And I got woodpeckers putting holes in it from time to time. Mm-hmm. And it's all specifically on one side of the house. I guess the first question, is there any simple way to repair a hole in wood siding other than just replacing the board?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, depending on how large the hole is, it is possible to use some epoxy fillers and, you know, it'll depend on the condition of everything on your home, but we do occasionally do that repair with epoxy, but then sometimes replacing the boards is the way to go. And, you know, there are products out there that look like cedar, but that, you know, are not. They're much harder. And if the woodpeckers
hit those, they're going to be they're going to be in for a little bit of a surprise. Well, you know what? We need to take a quick look at the news. We'll be back, and Bill will take care of the rest of your questions as well. Stay with us. Taking a look at home improvement issues today here on the Ideas Network, spring maintenance time for your home. And I tell you what, Chad Spate with us. Chad is owner of Chad's Design Build and has answers to your questions. Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller and so glad to have you with us today. Chad, when we broke for news, we had Bill online from Oregon wanting to know how to repair the woodpecker holes in the side of his house. And I think you got to the answer of that. And go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, I was just going to say that, you know, sometimes people try to put up decoys and things like that to try to discourage the woodpeckers. I mean, there are a variety of approaches, and, you know, sometimes people are effective, and sometimes those decoys and other things just don't quite do the trick. And I had made the recommendation when we went to break that sometimes you might consider mixing in some materials, like a smart siding product, which is a very dense kind of a particle board or composite product that is very, very hard, and a woodpecker will not easily be able to peck into it. Similarly, cement board siding can be used. And depending on whether or not there's a stain or a more of a solid paint-like finish on the siding, anything that is painted, you'll probably be able to match it.
An oil-based stain.
Oh, it's an oil-based stain?
Mm-hmm. Yep. I have a different approach. Because one thing I've learned over the years is that they'll test around the entire house. But they only pound if they get a very specific resonance. I mean, if they get the right sound. And the second question I wanted to ask was, is there anything I can put on the back of the boards that will alter the sound character of them that won't create any vapor transfer issues by locking in moisture on the back of the board? Because I've been trying to think of something that I might be able to apply to it that is just something to deaden that hollow response, because I'm reluctant to put any fill on that side of the house, because that's the only side of the house that has full airflow from the basement to the attic. For the most part. I mean, well, it's not completely open, but that seems to be the ventilation area that was set up for this house, or the primary
one.
Okay.
Well, that's a great question, and I imagine some experimentation would be in order. I will say that with the traditional wood siding, it's very important that the back of that siding be properly primed. And relating to that, often woodpeckers will essentially peck at parts of the house that have either bugs or potential rot damage underway. And so, you know, if the siding has been properly back primed, it's less likely to have those issues. And so it's less likely to then be appealing to the woodpecker. The problem is, you know, you've got an entire house with the siding, whatever was done to it, eventually it's going to wear and start to have some issues.
Oh, yeah.
And so it can be very frustrating to, you know, stay ahead of the woodpecker.
Only in the hollow sounding area.
Identifying.
Yeah. But you get it. It's where you get the hollow resonance. So
right.
I'm just trying to look for different approaches that might work because I don't know, I kind of like the wood, so.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, I like wood, too. Wood is a great material, and I would encourage you to, you know, stick with it if you can. And I, if you figure out a great way to, you know, to do what you're suggesting, then please call in again and let us know.
Yeah,
I'm
please
do. Intrigued by that.
Yeah, I would be as well, and a lot of other people would, too. Bill, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Chuck in Viroqua next. Chuck, hello to you.
Good morning, Larry and Chad. I'm converting a two-car garage into a woodworking shop. It's on a slab, and I've furred out the 2x4s to be 2x6s, and I'm insulating them with faced insulation. My first question is, I understand if it's faced insulation, I really don't need an additional vapor barrier. Is that true?
That's correct. Yeah, the facing, that kind of craft paper that's on the old-fashioned fiberglass insulation is a vapor retarder, and it's actually quite good vapor retarder.
Okay, my next question then is I'm trying to figure out how I want to heat this shop of mine. It's a standalone garage. It's not attached to the house, mm-hmm. and I'm considering wood, burning stove, I'm on propane, I'm out in the country, or, you know, something electric. And I'm thinking that the heat will solve a problem that I'm seeing is just a little bit of condensation on the cement floor during wet periods. Or should I consider coating that floor?
Well, those are great questions. I mean, one of the things you have to think about is any sort of heat that you generate with a fuel, like the propane, or with wood, there's a lot of moisture released in the burning of that. And of course, the electric heat would be a dry heat. So you're going to be adding moisture to the space, if you're using a fuel, and, you know, using combustion to generate that heat. So proper ventilation of that, of the, you know, the system itself and reducing the moisture in the space will be a concern depending on your heat source. The natural physics of a floor, that I imagine it's a slab on grade, for a detached two-car garage, is that accurate?
It's a slab on grade, detached.
Okay. So you will always be drawing some moisture out of that slab, depending on the conditions and the time of year. And so while it is true that the condensation problem might be resolved by the space and by warming up that slab, you're still going to potentially have moisture in the form of a vapor coming into the space by virtue of the things that you do in there because you will be conditioning the space. And so if you put a sealant down on the floor, you will help retard that moisture that's being wicked out of the ground. But you may find that, you know, the moisture is so persistent that the materials you use to finish that floor don't hold up as well. And there's no way to predict that at this point, but that is a possible danger, is that, you know, depending on how well you're able to prepare the floor for the the application of a sealant, and then just how persistent the issues are at your site with respect to the moisture in the ground, you know, those variables are going to impact how well that performs for you.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't see a problem in a workshop with putting some sort of a coating on the floor that would help to reduce the amount of moisture that you're pulling into that space.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Good luck, Chuck. Thank you so much for calling. Mary Ann in Sparta emailed to say she recently purchased a home with a partial finished basement. The one room that floods has a linoleum glued directly to the cement floor. There aren't any cracks in the cement floor or foundation walls. However, the entire area seems to get damp and fill with water during heavy rainfall. Can she use a sealant paint, or does something more expensive need to be done?
Well, those are great questions. I mean, I think when you've got bulk water coming into the space, you know, some sort of a sealant is not going to take care of the problem. And I suspect that if she doesn't have she either has a sump pump system that isn't working, or
she doesn't have one.
Tile. Okay. So,
or she doesn't have one. I'm not sure if she does or not.
Right. It sounds like she needs one. And unfortunately, that's going to require damaging that floor on the perimeter of that space. But that should take care of the water coming in. And then whatever floor she puts down, hopefully will stay dry.
Leslie in Cottage Grove, it's your turn. Hi, Leslie. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Chad. Thank you very much. I have a question regarding the insulation around the foundation of the house. The house was built in 92, and it is vinyl siding, and it has a walkout basement. There's two different kinds of insulation that I see, but I have seen a bird fly in and out of a hole in this coating, and there appear to be little nibbles around the ground level. I'm seeing a kind of this foam board that may have a gray coating on it and fibers. Words will fail me, but you know what this stuff is. And then another kind that looks like a regular foam board at the ground level, and that's what it looks like the chipmunks are chewing, but the bird is going in and out of this exposed basement kind of insulation that has the gray coating on it. Can I just take, like, great stuff and spray it to close these holes?
Well, that's a good question. So it sounds like you have an EIFS, or it's an engineered stucco system on the home. Would that be accurate?
It could be, because it looks like it's gray and on the
bumpy
part on the exposed on the exposed part of the basement. The stuff along the foundation ground level is different. The birds are flying out of the gray stuff, and I think chipmunks are gnawing into the stuff around the bottom of the house. What can I do?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would say that it probably needs to be looked at by a professional to figure out what exactly is going on and how your house is put together. Because while in the short term you might prevent these pests from nesting or, you know, coming into your home with something like great stuff, I would consider that a very temporary solution that wouldn't necessarily solve the problem. And I think we need to figure out, you know, why was the hole made in the first place? Often, when a bird or a burrowing animal comes into a home, there was something else going on first that led them to seize the opportunity to, you know, peck through or gnaw through and then make that little opening. And so we probably want to figure out what that might be. It could just be that the, you know, something happened you know, a branch hit the house or something and caused this opening and then led to this further, you know, infestation, if you will. But I hesitate to try to give you a solution without knowing how the house is really put together. If there is a cement foundation wall and you simply have a foam insulation over top of that, then that can probably just be repaired, and the rodents aren't likely to be able to get beyond the cement. But if they're getting into the wall of your home, and I suspect the birds are getting into the wall of the home, we're going to want to figure out how to patch that in a way that they don't easily come back. And, of course, now is the time to try to get them out of there before they start building the nest or, laying eggs.
Yes.
Because you'll either be entombing them or, we often don't do much from, say, April to July with birds in a home unless you just want to,
Yeah. Eliminate the birds
in the wall. I mean, it's not a good situation. So,
no. Okay.
But I wish you luck with that, and you might want to have someone come out and take a look at it.
Yeah, I think it's probably a good idea. Thank you, Leslie, for calling. Appreciate your call. And Barbara in Appleton has another question. Let's go there. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. My husband and I have a 4-bedroom home. All of the 4 bedrooms are on the second floor, and since we are empty nesters, I would like to knock a wall down and turn 2 of the bedrooms into 1 large one. So I'm not going to be doing this myself, but I want to know how I would go about finding out if there are any major structural beams like in there that shouldn't be knocked down.
Yeah, load-bearing sure. walls.
Great question. Generally you've got a couple of ways to figure that out. I mean, you could hire an architect or a structural engineer to assess your home. If you were thinking about either doing the work yourself or if simply you wanted someone with a particular credential that you could hire to, feel sure that you were not going to be asking some other person, a contractor or remodeler, to take responsibility for that. So that would be one approach. And then, if you were going to be hiring someone to do the work, you'd be getting this independent assessment, and then you could talk to contractors about the cost of then actually doing it, depending on what you find out. The other approach would be simply to find a contractor that you want to work with that would both assess the wall to determine what's necessary, if it is a load-bearing wall, and then be able to let you know what would be involved in removing it. Because I imagine if you're going to create a master bedroom or a larger bedroom, are you going to be adding a bathroom as well?
Well, our bathroom or our bedroom has a bathroom attached to it already.
Okay.
And the wall that we would be knocking down that separates these 2 bedrooms is a closet, basically.
Okay.
That's the only thing separating one room from the other.
Right.
It may not be a load-bearing wall.
Right, that's right. But it's impossible to know without assessing the home. And every home is unique. And so, but the good news that I can tell you is that typically, even if it is a load-bearing wall, it's not terribly difficult or expensive to put in an appropriate beam to carry the load of the trusses or the roof system that would be above it in a 2-story home. Removing a wall on the first floor of a two-story home is often a much more costly proposition when it's a load-bearing wall. But up on the second floor, we size those beams all the time, and it's typically not a very large beam. And then sometimes we put that beam up in the attic so that you don't even realize that there's a load and beam there.
Oh.
That might be able to be done in your case. Again, it depends on how the house is built.
Mm. Okay, so there may not even be a low bearing wall. There may not even be a beam in there.
Right.
Correct. It's possible that the wall does not serve any structural purpose, that it's just a partition, in which case, once that has been verified, it can be removed, and then you just have to attach the ceiling and the floor, and all would be taken out.
Yeah. So, be a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
For sure, if that's the case. But you need, as Chad says, you really need to find that out for sure, Barbara. So get somebody in there to take a look at that and figure out whether or not it's a load-bearing wall, for sure.
And you're probably going to want to pay someone, you know, to do that. I mean,
Yep, there you go.
Good luck.
Good luck. Thanks a lot, Barbara.
Thank you.
And another Barbara, this one in Milwaukee. What's on your mind, Barbara?
Okay, I have a duplex that I bought about 7 years ago. There was a brand-new garage and driveway built. The cement driveway, which seems to be conglomerate, is pitting terribly every winter. And I want to know what I can do, because if it continues like this, I'm going to just have a holy driveway.
Mm. Yeah, that's a tough one because, you know, there are many factors with the performance of cement and our climate. You know, it could be that the mix was not appropriate. It could be that the weather was challenged when the cement driveway was poured. There could be any number of explanations for a cement driveway
deteriorate. I had one put in, and they said, be sure not to put salt on it.
Uh-huh.
Right.
I haven't salted very much at all, so.
Okay.
Usually I use pet-friendly salt anyway. I don't use the harsh.
Yeah.
Right.
So about 30 seconds to go there, Chad.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know of any effective way to refinish a cement driveway given the challenges of our climate. So unfortunately, I think you're going to be looking at having parts of that driveway removed and replaced.
Oh.
But I wish you luck to that, and I hope you can find a less expensive way to deal with it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling. And, Chad, always a pleasure. You're going to be back.
Excellent.
Yeah, we're going to be back on May 11th. You and I will be talking.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
In the meantime.
I'll be in the studio.
Yeah, in the meantime, have fun in St. Petersburg.
Thank you very much.
Chad Spate. Chad is the owner of Chad's Design Build, and he comes by every other month to talk with us about home remodeling, home maintenance issues. And he'll be back again, as I said, on May 11th. Well, as always, there's lots more shows coming up. Kathleen Dunn will be talking with us at 1 o'clock about the fact that George Orwell's 1984 book is back on the bestsellers list. Then tomorrow, though, on Garden Talk, Mark Dwyer from the Janesville Rotary Gardens joins us to talk about fragrant plants that will work in your garden, and he'll take your gardening questions. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.